Good morning to each of you. My wristwatch says 9 o'clock. Your clock says there's 1 minute, so that gives some folks some time to come on in and find their seats. And now Rick is saying, yeah, it is 9 o'clock. So I am, my name is Eric Marshall. For those who don't know me, I'm serving as bishop here at Bowmansville and for the Valley Mountain PA East District. And it's a joy to be with you this morning. I want to welcome the folks who are watching by live stream. It's so good that you're here this morning. We know that you wish you could actually be in the building, but for different reasons you couldn't be here. But nonetheless, we're so thankful that you would join us here this morning. This 100th anniversary celebration weekend, it started off last night, and it has been good so far. And I look forward to learning more today. This morning, Ken Sensnig is with us. His brother Carl was with us last night. But this morning, Ken is with us. And I had to ask my wife, Cheryl, to tell me a little bit about Ken, because Ken was one of her teachers at Gaiman's as well. Now, the thing that surprises me is she remembers all of the stories that Ken would tell. But he was her science teacher. I'm thinking, how many stories can there be in science class? I thought maybe she'd have, well, he gave us this great method of learning the periodic table or something. No, it was the stories that she remembers. And I think for those of us who teach and preach, that's a good reminder. People remember the stories. And so Ken, I've gotten to know Ken over the years through MCC, and folks in our church would ask, hey, do you mind if I call Ken to ask him about this or that? And I always said, go right ahead. Ken's spoken at Blainsport, where I pastor, and I know he's no stranger here at Bowmansville either. So Ken, would you come up and share in this Sunday school hour? And I want to lead in a word of prayer before you begin. Father God, thank you so much for this 100th anniversary of being in this building. Your hand of faithfulness has been upon this congregation, and we are so grateful for that. And this morning, as Ken leads our thoughts, as he remembers some of the stories, we don't discount them. We realize that you were working in people's lives, and we want to see about how you did that and what that means for our lives. You are a God through the ages who walk with your people. And so, God, we give you our attention as Ken tells these stories for us this morning. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Is 10 minutes a long period of time? I don't know the answer to that question. It's a simple, simple question. And I suspect you don't know the answer to that question either, even though it's a simple, simple question. Of course, what's missing? What is the context? If you were to go up and go over in Bowmansville Road from 625 to my brother Lowell's poultry farm, where he has those big chicken houses strung out, and you would ask Lowell, a few months ago, when you walked in that empty chicken house, new shavings on the floor, and you saw a red glow in the shavings and smoke filling the chicken houses, and you waited 10 minutes for the Adamstown Fire Company to come, is 10 minutes a long time? Do you know what he would say? Do you know what he has said? Yes, it's the longest 10 minutes of my life. I learned about that sort of roundabout just shortly afterwards. I didn't have any details in it, so I texted Lowell. Everything okay on the farm? He said, close call, minimal damage, he said. Fire company got there. How about if you're riding with me to take my son to the train station in Lancaster, and we're stuck at the intersection of Route 222 South and 30 West? Did you ever get in that traffic along? And it's 10 minutes until the train goes. Is 10 minutes a long time? Well, no, you would see my grip on the steering wheel, the set of my jaw. You would know that 10 minutes is not much time at all. Context makes all the difference. And I understand that to be my assignment here this morning, that we're going to look at the Bowmansville setting when this Meeting House was built 100 years ago. On January 26th this month, it will be 100 years that they had the dedication service here. Of course, the construction was taking place before then. So that's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at the context. And one of the themes that came to my mind as I looked at this and when Helen asked me for a title, I said, well, why don't we just borrow that phrase? Interesting, we sang this song last night as well. Chance and change are busy ever. You know this song. It's 372 in your church and Sunday school hymnal there in front of you. That's what we're going to see here. Chance is just how things happen. Change is inevitable, and we're going to see a lot of that as we go through these slides here. Let's just sing these few phrases here on the screen. It's 372 if you would care to turn to it, but we'll sing just this one verse. Chance and change are busy ever. Worlds decay and ages move. Let his mercy waneth never. God is light and God is love. That's the affirmation we want to remember this morning. God is love. As we remember, we're in a solid biblical stream of remembering. Remember in the Old Testament how it was so important to remember the Exodus, to remember the stones piled on out from the Jordan River, the 12 stones, so that when they shall ask, do you remember Jesus at the first, shall we call it, communion service, a building on the Passover, do this in remembrance of me. So we are remembering this morning. And what I'd like to do is take these concentric circles I put here and place the Bowmansville Mennonite Church in the context so we can answer the question, is 10 minutes a long period of time? We can understand the context in which this congregation built this meeting house 100 years ago. So we're going to go from the outside in. We're going to look at the world, and we're going to look at the U.S. We're going to look at the Mennonite scene here in the U.S. We're going to look at the conference in the district and then come to this congregation here. First of all, we look at the world. The first decades of the 20th century brought many, many, many changes from earlier ways of doing things, and that becomes obvious as we look at the history. We're only going to pick and choose just a few examples. This is not exhaustive in any way. Many of you will recognize the Arm and Hammer, or the Sickle and the Hammer, and you'll recognize the Soviet Union there. The Soviet Union formed in 1922, the same year in which the dedication service was held in this building here. And that had a profound impact on this congregation. It did. That'll become more clear. The context will become more clear as we go along. But the formation of the Soviet Union impacted the activities of this congregation. And of course, this is also something that impacted this congregation, as many, many other places. The British Broadcasting Company started in 1922. It evolved into the British Broadcasting Corporation in several years. But this became sort of the first broad spread use of the radio. And the 1920s and 1930s, radio significantly impacted this church. And I would say it continues to significantly impact this church. These global kinds of things had an impact on this congregation and the context in which we are worshiping today. Chance and change are busy ever. Worlds decay and ages move. But his mercy waneth never. God is light and God is love. American society changed as well. This map is not quite accurate. I couldn't easily find a map that was accurate. Some of you will be old enough to remember that the last two states tucked down in the corner there in a geographic box were not part of the United States in 1922. The most recent admissions were New Mexico and Arizona 10 years previously, but the U.S. was still geographically taking shape when this building was built in 1922. But what was happening in American society in 1922? Well, you should be aware that there was a pandemic going on, diphtheria. Diphtheria was a major issue right in this area. It was close on the heels of the Spanish flu pandemic and some of the other pandemics that Carl mentioned last night where a lot of people lost their lives. I have memories of just a few decades ago tramping through the cemetery at the Weaverland Church, the upper church there, which is actually the older part of the cemetery. The upper building actually is not the original site of the original Weaverland Church. The one down, the brick church down the hill, is the original Weaverland site. But I remember tramping around that cemetery, and we came upon a stone for Mary Zimmerman. And there my grandfather, John Burkholder, stopped, and he said, "Ken, if she had lived, this is the woman I would have married." And then, of course, that gives me all kinds of thoughts. What if he had done that? There wouldn't have been my mother, and if there hadn't been my mother, there wouldn't have been me. And well, where would it be? And then he talked about Mary getting diphtheria. She was 17 years old, just past her 17th birthday. And he said, "When I went to visit, we had to visit through the window, I'm presuming with the glass down, because it was so, so contagious." You can see there that hundreds of thousands of people got the disease and thousands of people died. This is in 1921 was her date of death. It's interesting to think about that, right when they were tearing down the old building here and constructing this building, there was pandemic all around. It would be very interesting to know how they dealt with that. One of the other things happening in U.S. society in 1922 was a dedication of the Lincoln Memorial. Most of you have visited that. May 30, just a few months after the dedication service of this building, there was a dedication of that building on your screen. It's interesting to think about that this was not that far removed from the American Civil War. There were many, many firsthand memories and firsthand accounts still of those years in the 1860s here in this congregation, and some of the people who reached back pretty far there. That's Abraham Lincoln's one surviving son, Robert Lincoln, on the screen on the right. And then two presidents, the one Taft on the left was former president and now was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and President Warren Harding. These three men were together at the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial in 1922. Right about the time that this church was being torn down, the previous church torn down, this one being built, was one of the biggest racial incidents in American history. Some of you heard about this because the centennial passed just last year. It was a huge area of Tulsa, Oklahoma, that was torched and burned because of racial strife. And people lost their lives, and people remember that to this day. It happened to be one of the wealthiest areas of African American population in the country. Sometimes it was known as the Black Wall Street. And so this is a picture of that racial strife that was underway right the time the changeover of this building right here was happening. And of course, in the same social context, we had women just getting the right to vote just a bit earlier. And so we see that this is a picture of sort of anti-women voting. The guy with the mustache is sitting there with a bunch of bawling babies, and his wife is going out to vote. That's what the sign behind the feather in her hat says. So the 19th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution in 1920 guaranteed the women's right to vote. This initiative of seeing women as equal players in society impacted this congregation as well. And so we're seeing the context. We understand better whether 10 minutes is a long period of time or not, because we're going to see the context in which this congregation built this new meeting house. Here's a local Mennonite guy from the little tiny community of Conestoga in southern Lancaster County, Amos Kling. He moved from Conestoga to Ohio. There he married, and they had a daughter, Florence. Florence grew into a rebellious child, a teenager. She would not listen to her father. She had a hasty marriage and a divorce. And, of course, in the Mennonite context in that era, that created all kinds of questions. And then she started working for a newspaper guy in Marion, Ohio. And this newspaper guy was actually at odds with Amos Kling. And so Florence is there, and she falls in love with Warren, the newspaper guy. So Warren and Amos, with Florence in between, are having this big conflict, and finally Amos Kling conspires with another man to buy up a debt that Warren owes to someone, and they bought a $20,000 debt and said, your debt is now due. It almost doomed him. Wouldn't you know that Florence, Amos Kling's daughter, married Warren, and he said to his wife, you may not go to the wedding. She sneaked in enough to see the wedding, but for 8 years, Amos Kling didn't talk to his daughter. This is his daughter here. Florence Kling Harding. She married Warren Harding. She became the first lady when her husband Warren Harding became president in 1921. There was a woman from Mennonite Lancaster County background living in the White House when this building was built. And here is her husband. He is generally seen by historians to be a very, very weak president. Part of it perhaps is because, as Florence Kling Harding said, she has only one hobby, and that's her husband. She was more ambitious for him to be president than for her to be president. Perhaps in a different era, she would have run for president. But they're also a prime example, right in the era when this church was built, in national politics, a prime example of how not to have good family relations. A pretty poor testimony, actually, from Amos Kling, born in Conestoga, Pennsylvania, into a Mennonite family. And of course, in the 1920s, vehicle ownership was increasing dramatically. Here's a Maxwell car, 1045. I looked online. You can buy one just about like this model today for in the region of 15,000 to 16,000, if any of you have a hankering to do that. With the car then comes all kinds of changes. The Pennsylvania Turnpike wasn't just up the road here at that point yet. The Turnpike was not built. I think the western part was built first and then the eastern part a little bit later. But the car brought many, many changes. And one of those changes is that now there's more liability. You might damage people and property with the car in a way you typically would not do with a horse. And so Wayne Martin and some other folks down in Goodville, they got together, Mennonite folks, and said, you know, this brotherly aid kind of sharing when people had loss in the past was good enough, but now cars change that. And so they founded the Goodville Mutual Casualty Company, which remains in the insurance industry. Goodville now over in New Holland is rated as a top-notch company by the insurance industry. A small company, but a very prosperous and very good company. Started with Mennonites in Goodville, because of the automobile. This is how Bowmansville changed because of the advent of the car. This is construction of what was then Route 73, today Route 625 through Bowmansville. Up until then, it had just been a gravel road. It's hard for me to emphasize how this changes things. We now have paved roads. We have a paved road to Bowmansville. We have people driving cars. We have people listening to radios. They're hearing stuff from around the world. The world is different in 1921 and 1922. And so there's change all around. One of the things that came in is this prohibition, a U.S. Constitution amendment to outlaw the production and use of alcohol. Interestingly enough, as some of you know, that one of the first, the very first brewery in this neighborhood here was a Swiss Mennonite immigrant. I think he actually came from Switzerland, Francis Diller. He lived just over here close to Trossel's Hill. And nobody knows exactly where he's buried. He's buried in the cemetery that predates the construction of the Pine Grove Church. So that's where he's buried. His widow is buried out near Diller Mennonite Church in central Pennsylvania because she lived much longer than he did and moved with her family out there. But prohibition was the law of the land from 1920 to 1933. So if any of these workers building this church were drinking any hard cider at lunchtime, they were doing something illegal in that era. You can see, chance and change are busy ever. Chance and change are busy ever. Worlds decay and ages move. But his mercy waneth never. God is light and God is love. It should be no surprise at all that all these changes in society were also impacting the Mennonites in America. Life is changing, adopting new things. In this congregation, earlier, there was already migration from the German language to the English language. That meant a change in songbooks. That meant a change in the language of worship and the religious language. You lose some terms that describe ideals in German that don't have a good parallel in English. Things are changing. Incomes before 1922, 1921, incomes the very controversial things like Sunday school, borrowing these English ideas of how to do church, empowering people to teach the word who have no specific call through ordination to teach the word. They're called Sunday school teachers, or as some people derisively called them in that era, Sunday school preachers. And you have protracted meetings where you have these evangelists coming in, and many times in an emotional way, inviting people to get right with God. And so this is a whole new way of doing church, which predates the change of this building, but also forces some things to change when you make a new building to accommodate these kinds of things. One, of course, is obvious. If you're going to have evening protracted meetings for 2 weeks, you should have electricity in your building. And so that would be one of the changes. Mennonite churches get institutionalized. Just a couple examples. Mennonite Publishing House, 1908, again predating the 20s. Eastern Mennonite University, EMU, 1917. These are things that are impacting this congregation before the decision is made to build a new church, but feeding into this way of saying we need a new church building to accommodate new understandings. One of the profound impacts in American conservative Christians in America in the 19-teens and 1920s, what is sometimes called Christian fundamentalism. And so you see Christian fundamentalism in the 1920s, rapid social change in the early 20th century, invited people to reach out and sort of say, here are some things that we will not change. And so there was a movement to establish Christian fundamentals, a series of pamphlets written in the 19-teens, and impacted the Mennonites. This was, again, some new understandings to try to push back against what was impacting the larger Christian community. This is a large and complex topic, and we won't deal with this morning, but one of the keys that help you to understand the impact of Christian fundamentalism is when people started to argue about the inerrancy of the scriptures, to say that the scriptures are without error, the word is inerrant. That's sort of, in some ways, an indicator of what is impacting people who are making such statements. That was not something that Mennonites thought much about or argued about. The Bible shows us how to live. The important thing is how we live, what is in our heads, and what are the arguments about authorship and historicity of the scriptures is not something we need to argue ourselves about. And so it was a new kind of thing, but it most definitely impacted these churches right here like Bowmansville. And so in 1921, the statement of faith, which was in place when this church house changed over from the old to the new, look what it says. This is new. This is new. This is new forces on the Mennonite church in 1921. Authoritative in its councils, inerrant in its original writings, and the only infallible rule of faith and practice. That was impacting this congregation. Interestingly enough, it's interesting to see how a century later, some folks have backed away from some of those kinds of arguments, and it has created some of the variety that we see in our churches here today. For example, Pine Grove Mennonite Church, just Pine Grove Church now here in Bowmansville, wasn't formed because of this issue. It actually was formed earlier because, and some of you know this story, the big argument about public versus local education, and some folks got kicked out of this congregation, and the folks from the General Conference down in towards Franconia said, well, you can start another church even though you're kicked out of that one. So that's how Pine Grove got started. But Pine Grove today is part of the Association of Mennonite Evangelical Congregations, and one of the reasons that formed, one of the primary players behind it, he told me specifically, he said, because the current Mennonite church statement does not use the word inerrant. And so Pine Grove subscribes to the Mennonite Association of Mennonite Evangelical Congregations in inerrant. The Hinkletown Mennonite Church doesn't find a home for its connection, so it's an independent church. And if you go to Hinkletown, they'll say, we like this word inerrant. I trust that they know that it was a more recent invention, but these are some things that create divisions even in our church today. This is the statement of faith that this congregation was using when it was building the new church. interestingly enough, that issue was so hot and unsettled in 1922, 1923, that Goshen College had to close. The board of directors said, we just have to reset here. And so they actually closed the college because of this argument between fundamentalism, a new sort of head knowledge of faith, versus what the others, what they would have termed on the other side as modernism. This was a big... A big question at Goshen College. Interestingly enough, and I go back to my grandfather, John Burkholder. Some of you would remember him, ordained at Waverly in 1940 for the district, which included this congregation at that point. But he was a little out of character. In the 1920s, he was a married farmer, part of the Lancaster Conference, but coming out of the old order. And he enrolled in a correspondence course with Moody Bible Institute. And so here was someone from the very old sort of discipleship traditions, not worrying too much about some of these heady fundamentalist arguments. And then he's imbibing stuff at the Moody Bible Institute, which would stand pretty much in the fundamentalist tradition. And he starts imbibing that. And when it actually came time for his ordination, that became a matter of some cross-examination before he could join the lot in 1940 at Waverland. But you know, he became a person widely read. He was the manager of the used book section of Provident Bookstore for a couple of decades and read widely. And he actually came out of that understanding of fundamentalism, and he had a change of mind after he was ordained. And I have a statement that he hand wrote. It says, I'll read it in part of it. The thing that made me rethink position on the prophecy question, that was a big question about fundamentalism, was a dust that was kicked up by the ultra-fundamentalists over the new RSV, Revised Standard Version, 1947, of the Bible. I am come to see the import of the spiritual message of the Bible becoming an entirely new book and a new appreciation, a new message and outlook. I have found my way to a new realistic and scriptural faith and application of the message of the Christian scriptures. Of this I am sure, that there is a present reality of the kingdom of heaven, a very Anabaptist thing to say, in which some future time will find its fullness, but just what that fullness is one of the mysteries of the scriptures, in spite of the fact that they are the divine revelation. The one who claims the Bible is more modern than today's newspaper, or tomorrow's newspaper, he writes, which was something prophecy conferences, which he had earlier participated in, said. The Bible is more up to date. If you want to know what's going to happen, you read the Bible. You don't need to read the newspaper. Someone who says that, my grandfather notes, is simply displaying his ignorance concerning the spiritual, intelligent use of the scriptures. In all things, the Bible is a book dealing with broad principles, wide areas covering cycles of time. So he came through sort of that fundamentalist movement, which was impacting this congregation in the 1920s, studied at Moody, and then came back to sort of a more historic Anabaptist understanding, and saying that it's a much deeper understanding beyond the empirical heady study of the scriptures. Chance and change are with us everywhere. Tractors became in wide usage, and this tractor here stands for a representation of the origins of the Mennonite Central Committee in 1920, but actually became very active in 1921 and 1922. That was impacting this congregation. Forts and tractors were purchased, and 50 of them sent to the Mennonites in Russia so that they could replace the horses that had been lost and stolen. Mennonite Central Committee really sort of tested the church, because this was a coming together of folks who were unlike each other. The Pine Grove and the Bowmansville people actually have to say, we can work together, Mennonite Central Committee, 100 years ago. It was a loosely assembled ad hoc committee called Mennonite Central Committee. The full intention was that after the initial crisis of starvation in Russia was passed, it would circle back and make a more formal organization. And the board of Mennonite Central Committee in 1924 voted to disband itself. Well, it's still going 101, 102 years later. That's because they could not get some of the more tradition-minded, the old Mennonite church of which Lancaster Conference was a part, they refused to enter a more formal arrangement with people unlike themselves. And so today we still have this loose federation that doesn't draw solid lines between churches who don't want to be like each other. And so the Fords and Tractor Mennonite Central Committee, a sign of the times in 1920, there are things are changing, but there are some things that we've are better off if we keep it fairly loose. Chance and change are busy ever, worlds decay and ages move, but his mercy waneth never. God is light and God is love. So we have the Lancaster Mennonite Conference and the local district here. The district now even doesn't use the names I have up there. What's it called? The Mountain Valley PA? Valley Mountain, PA East, but Groffdale would be part of that, Martindale District. But all of these churches that you sort of know in this northeast corner of Lancaster County would have been all one district. And by district, we simply mean it is under the administration of one specific bishop. And so that was the case here. Although the bishop in this area was a little bit indistinct, because when this bishop of this congregation in 1893 was kicked out of the Lancaster Conference because he spoke so forcefully for tradition, that's what's formed the old orders. For 10 years, there was no resident bishop. It was just bishops coming in, visiting from other districts until almost 10 years, until 1902, there was a new bishop ordained. In this era, predating this church building here, but just by a few years, was the Eastern Mennonite Missions, finally incorporated after there were mission interests back as early as 1894. And over at Weaverland, they had a missions committee. But in 1914, then Eastern Mennonite Missions and Board of Charities comes together. And of course, this is something new. This is not something that Bowmanville Mennonites would have done before in working on these missions efforts. One of the very first efforts was to invite people to participate in world needs. And so we have sewing circles cropping up back in the late 1800s. And then here in Lancaster Conference, sewing circles are starting in the early 1900s. Bowmansville, interestingly enough, had one of the earliest sewing circles. There's a book over here of the minutes from the very first meeting in 1910. I was interested. I looked at the cover of the notebook that has all these minutes in, and I think it's a battleship on the cover, and it says "Our Navy." So it was an interest. Somebody's notebook it was just a colorful notebook with a pretty picture on. And so anyway, you can see that there were conflicts going on, perhaps even then. This is not a Bowmansville picture. This is just a placeholder. This might be over perhaps in the Mellinger congregation, although I'm not exactly sure about that. And then in 1922, this got kicked into a whole nother level. This big brick building, which still stands right along Route 30, you can drive past and see that little round door on the bottom floor there under the porch. It's very characteristic. But on the third floor of this building, Eastern Mennonite Missions in 1922 set up a cutting room or a sewing room. They're going to sew. Eastern Mennonite Missions is going to sew for this relatively new entity that is sending materials overseas called Mennonite Central Committee. So Eastern Mennonite Missions supporting the material craft of Mennonite Central Committee operating out of that building, which still stands to this day from 1922. The latest installment of that effort, some of you are familiar with, sometimes called the cutting or the sewing room, which is in the Material Resources Center in Ephrata for Mennonite Central Committee. It essentially migrated with Norman Shank's help from EMM to MCC about 30 years ago. And this was some of the very first mission work that local Mennonites did. Went up in the Welsh Mountain, former slaves, families of former slaves, folks who couldn't afford nice farmland. They went up in the rocky hills of the Welsh Mountain that couldn't be farmed. And it was a pretty poor area economically, spiritually, socially. And Eastern Mennonite Missions went up on the hill to start working with the folks in the Welsh Mountain. Arthur Moyer was shot by someone stealing corn from his corn crib in 1924. This is all in the era when this church building was being done. And that closed the industrial mission. We still have the legacy of this early mission work in the 1920s that remains yet with the Welsh Mountain home up there and the Welsh Mountain church. That's a direct descendant from this work that was going on here among local Mennonites. So this is change that's happening. And after getting over the shock of the bishop being excommunicated in 1893, the local ministry here is ready to ordain another church leader, another bishop. And Benjamin Weaver was ordained. I don't imagine there's anyone who would have memories of him, but you would certainly know of him. He was a very active bishop. He was moderator of the conference for a period of time, for 26 years. He was the bishop in this large district. Remember, this is Martindale, Weaverland, Groffdale, and points in between. He has written extensive diaries, which exist to this day, and I find those very, very interesting. Every once in a while, I get to make a connection. I was reading his diaries recently, and I read that on June 2, 1921, that's while the old building was being torn down here, on June 2, 1921, they went to Weaverland Church for an ordination, and they ordained Deacon Harry Souter. I feel a sense of connection to that because I'm old enough to remember Deacon Harry Souter, who died just short of 100 in the very late 60s. This brother got Benjamin Weaver got in trouble. In fact, there was some concern that he would be charged with espionage because he attended a meeting at the Yellow Creek Mennonite Church in Ohio, I believe. Ohio, Indiana, Yellow Creek Church, and he had signed on to a statement protesting isn't the right word, a testimony against the war going on, the great war to end all wars that ended in 1918, today we call it World War I, and there were folks who were getting into trouble because they were speaking against the war. There was a Eugene Debs who was an activist who actually was in prison, tried for sedition because he was speaking against the war. There was some concern the same fate might befall Benjamin Weaver, but the war came to an end before those who had signed that Yellow Creek statement got in trouble. He was a wise man. There were issues, of course, about musical instruments, even in the home and certainly in the church during his time. And some people then, as now, tried to push the edges a little bit. So he got wind one day that this home wedding that he was attending, they were about to use their new family organ sort of as the entrance for the bride to come in. And that would just have been out of order if the church is presiding even at the home. We will not be having instrumental music. How do you tell a bride who's all excited about her wedding that you've come to dump rain on her parade, literally? The word is that Bishop Ben got there in plenty of time, and they tried to show him his seat, but he insisted on sitting on the organ stool. And when they said, "Oh, Brother Bishop, there's a much more comfortable seat over here," he said, "No, this is fine. This is fine. I will stay right here." And he did. And there was no organ music, and no one had to say anything about it. So there, chance and change was at play. It was a difficult time, but things were also going well. This is the roaring 20s. People are prosperous. Folks in this area got wealthy because prices of tobacco and wheat and other commodities among the farms went up during World War II. So people are wealthy. That's why they're buying cars. But it's also a building program. So over in New Holland in 1921, they said, "We will build a new church." And so they did in 1921. And then over at Bowmansville in 1922, they said, "We're going to build a new church." New Holland, of course, now is the Spanish congregation there. And then over in Goodville. Goodville predates the 1920s, but it was, I think it was in this construction where they actually took Goodville church building and cut it in half and pushed the two parts apart and then built in between. And that was in 1924. Business is booming in the Lancaster Mennonite churches. And then over at Weaverland, they got tired of their old stone building, and in 1926, they built the new Weaverland Church. So that's the main auditorium part that exists today at Weaverland. They built on both ends, I think, but this was a building program in the context of this local district back in 1922. Two primary themes among the Lancaster Mennonites in 1922, and some of you would know because this spilled over long past that, but these would have been issues that were important in the church in 1922. This church building, non-resistance. Some of you remember perhaps an older cover for the book Coals of Fire of people who stood up for Christ's way of peace in time of testing. Some of you know the story pictured on that book there, throwing the thatched roof off Preacher Peter's house, and after they worked hard, he goes out and he says, "You guys have worked hard. you might want to come in for some breakfast. And he invited them to come in to eat, and then they went back and put the thatch back up on it again. A nonconformity, be not conformed to this world. And I used this book here about Waverland Mennonites, be not conformed to this world. But nonconformity was an important issue that you don't run with the world in many, many respects in the 1922 meeting house where when they first met here. Here's an example of the Lancaster Conference discipline. The discipline of Lancaster Conference, which had statements of faith and rules and discipline of how the church should organize itself and how the church should be. The rules and discipline edition that would have been in place in 1922, 1921 was the 1915 rules and discipline. And interestingly enough, we see the temperance movement and the prohibition, which was coming into that rules and discipline. So there's a solemn protest against traffic in intoxicating liquor, unlike Francis Diller, who had the first brewery here. So we see changes happening in numerous ways. There was a lot of good theologically sound stuff in this rules and discipline book that was used. But for many, many people, as time went on, it became more and more seen as simply a way of trying to control the congregation, particularly in the way people dressed. Many of you here are old enough to remember that this was a major, major issue. And unfortunately, for the very, very good stuff, sound theological teaching that was in that statement of faith and rules and discipline, it often got overshadowed by people butting up against ways that nonconformity was being interpreted. Interestingly enough, the very first formal listing of how people should dress didn't come from the bishop board until 1926, so that was after this building was built. But some of you will remember these kinds of issues. Most of the time, the church in the East, Bowmansville, Lancaster, Virginia, was more conservative than the church in the West, but there was one thing where the churches in Indiana and Ohio made a turn towards more conservatism ahead of the East, and that was wearing the long necktie. The long necktie was generally discouraged against, but sometimes they wore the bow ties and so forth. Sometimes you'll still see among the old orders that the bow tie is worn. But Noah Mack, who actually was serving with Benjamin Weaver as co-bishop here for a period of time, had traveled out west where he was exposed to teaching against the necktie, and he came back and he ditched his tie. But his wife discouraged him from taking a second trip to the church in the West. She said, last time he went out, he came back without his tie. I'm afraid if he goes again, he might come back without his shirt. And so she didn't want him to come back that way. Venora Weaver and Vesta Zook were some of the first MCC workers. Now, they were not from a plain church as such, but they had to meet the expectations of the plain church to serve with Mennonite Central Committee. And so when they were sailing to work with refugees in Turkey coming out of the conflict in Russia in 1921, they had to dress as expected by the conservative elements of Mennonite Central Committee. So they dutifully wore their bonnets. But the word is that once they were out on the high sea, the bonnets were ditched in the ocean. And so that's how they dealt with that. They met the expectations in Scottsdale, where MCC was headquartered at that point, and then they moved on to what they thought they needed to do to work in that cross-cultural context. So we don't need to be surprised, do we? Chance and change are busy ever. Worlds decay and ages move. But his mercy waneth never. God is light and God is love. So they're going to build a new church at Bowmansville. A decision is made in 1921. It seemed to go very, very fast. They met with the ministry in April of 1921. By May, they were ready to start tearing the building down. And they didn't have to get all the permits today. It would cost a lot of time and a lot of money to do something like that. They didn't have to do a land development plan. They didn't have to do the sewage field test, and they didn't need building permits. So it happened very, very quickly. This is what the old building looked like. Many of you have seen this picture. It would have been situated somewhere oriented the other way. The long way of the building was this way, so it would be turned as that. And the preacher's table as the old order churches are today. Yet some of you have been in some of the old order churches. The preacher's table would have been down at that side, the north side, and then the women around this side, and the men around this side, and the singer's table in between. Those of you who have been to the other Bowmansville Mennonite church, where two groups meet, you would have seen that. And the picture shows you that there was horse rails behind, and I believe that's the buggy shed that's down towards the north side. At some point then, after the old orders departed, they changed, I believe, about 1906 and put the, I think Henry Horning told me, the pulpit then would have been on the east side over here. So they sort of turned it to make kind of a more modern church. Change is happening, and you're going to have revival meetings, and you're going to have bigger groups, and so you try to orient yourself in the same building, but eventually that became untenable. In that period, and many of you know this, the three congregations right in the neighborhood here met on rotating Sundays. So Bowmansville, Gaiman's, and Allegheny was on a rotating preaching schedule. Allegheny, which is there today, yet if you've never been in the Allegheny Church, make it a point to go. And this preserves what this building would have looked like in many respects, or would have been like before the changeover. You don't have indoor plumbing, you don't have electricity, and a list of things there that have changed in this period of time. This is what the Gospel Herald says is going on at Bowmansville, May 14, 1921. I like the last phrase particularly because IGM, probably Israel G. Musser, but I'm not certain, in writing, he just used his initials as they often did. But his assessment is that the brethren of the rising generation seem to see the necessity of this work. I'm not quite sure if he sees it or not, but the rising generation sees the necessity of this work. Interestingly enough, the tearing down of the building was delayed. Moses Game and his wife Sally, they had a little one-year-old girl. I have to wonder if it was diphtheria, but I don't know. She died days before this time set to tear down this old building that was here. And they were going to start on a Tuesday, but Rhoda's funeral was scheduled for Wednesday. So they waited one day until Thursday of that week, the day after Rhoda Gaiman's funeral. Her stone is out here, row 6, just right near the bottom of the hill, the lower part of the cemetery. Go look at this little one-year-old. I had to wonder what the preacher here, who had been ordained in 1912, sat in this building knowing that his daughter is dead, she will be buried, and the memories of her funeral being in this meeting house is going to fall to the hammers, the sledgehammers, tomorrow. Moses Gaiman was this memorable kind of very quiet introvert pastor, I understand. In fact, when he was ordained in 1912 and he was at the services were at Gaiman's church the next Sunday, it was the expectation that the new preacher would have the opening, the shorter message, the devotion sometimes we called it. And he actually fainted at the entrance to the church as he was going in. He recovered and had his devotions, but he woke up out in the buggy shed between a couple buggies with some brethren trying to encourage him to take heart, he will be okay. This is the program. There's a real copy displayed over here. A whole lineup of local Mennonite dignitaries coming to help to celebrate this. Both English and German, the transition was still happening. Bring your own hymnal, bring your own lunch. And so this is M.G. Weaver from Weaverland writing in 1922. And he lists all the people who came. There was quite an event. Can you imagine having an all-day service on a Thursday today? I mean, who's going to come? But these folks came from far and wide. I listed some of the preachers there from some of the places. These are the bishops on January 26, 1922. This slide, I think, isn't quite technically correct. The Church and Sunday School hymnal would have been here because it was published in the early 1900s. Church hymnal was existence, but I don't know exactly when this congregation started to use it. That maybe you can comment to that with me. These songbooks had shaped notes. Jesse Eichen, Church of the Brethren member, thought it could be easier to sing if you didn't have to figure out which of the scale, do, re, mi, fa, so, each note represented, but if each one had a unique shape. And so at least some, maybe all of the songbooks in your rack today, still have those shaped notes, and some of you sing using the shaped notes. And that was in the 1922 church. And of course, we have the Old Order Church here, two groups meeting in the Old Order Church. And so in 1922, we have the seeds of the Cold War, which led to the trouble in Russia, led to Mennonite Central Committee, led to the real kicking off of sewing circles impacted this church. We have the pace of life increasing, cars, telephone, and so forth. We have global awareness building because of EMM, MCC. We have women coming into new roles. The sewing circles had women coming together. They were praying. They were talking about spiritual stuff. They were leading singing. This is the women getting the right to vote in 1920 coming to fruition, the Mennonite Church sewing circles. Women are exercising leadership in the sewing circles. So we have 100 years of God's faithfulness. Here is the entire song that we look at when we turn to page 372. I thought we might sing it, but I think we won't. But we will sing verse 2. Let's sing verse 2. Chance and change are busy ever. Worlds decay and ages move. But his mercy waneth never. God is light and God is love. My hope had been for a bit of time for a question, comment, and discussion, but we'll have to defer that to lunchtime. I would certainly welcome corrections, additions, thoughts that were prompted by this presentation. I hope that the message is clear, that there is chance and change, but God is light and God is love. And thank you to all of you who helped to plan this program, and thank you for the invitation for me to share with you. God bless you.